Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Drive Through HR. This is Robin Schooling, and I am here today with my co-host, Michael Vandervoort. Michael, how are you?
I'm good, Robin. We're doing a second show inside a week. We're on a roll here this week, so that's great.
It's the mid-year holiday roll or something. I don't know.
Right. we go on hiatus a month at a time sometimes. I mean, that's what we've done recently because we both have day jobs. But I'm good.
Right.
Yeah. You said you were sweltering. It's less sweltering where I am, but only by a couple degrees. So it's pretty warm, but I'm in an air conditioned office, so it's all good.
Yes. Well, we do drive through from the comfort of our studios / home offices / offices. So we're good. We are
exactly.
Good. But let's dive into our show today. I'm very much looking forward to our guest because I think the more I have learned about him as the ramp up to this show, the more fascinating his outlook and his career and everything is to me. So welcome everyone to the show, Don Robertson, who is the EVP and CHRO of Northwestern Mutual Life. Hello, Don.
Hi, Robin and Michael. It's great to be here with you today.
Thanks for joining us.
It is fabulous. And we've got a lot of things to talk about and your fascinating HR journey, and especially a lot of the things that you've worked on at, I'm just going to say NML, because of course, you know, that's my tendency is to always use that.
We still use that as well a lot ourselves too. So that's okay.
Good. As we kick our show off here, Don, we're going to ask you mm-hmm. to tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I mean, as I've said on a number of occasions, I probably don't have your typical career trajectory and what it took to get into be an HR person. I mean, I'm married. I've got two boys, 19 and 22. I've been with my wife for almost close to 40 years. It's dating and married. So we're in Milwaukee. We have a beautiful house in Fox Point on the lake. And so it's just a big dog lover. So anything animals is a big hit for me. Avid fitness guy. I'm really and golfer. So I don't have a lot of hobbies, but I'm very passionate about the ones I do, and I enjoy collecting wine. From a career standpoint, I grew up in, as I said, Central California. Played a lot of baseball. Started my career though in the business side. I'm actually an accounting and a marketing major. Which I will tell you later on why I think that has a lot of advantages for what I do today. And I spent the first probably, 18, 19 years of my career in various finance, general management, sales roles. So I'm a CPA by original background, long before though, Sarbanes-Oxley and some of the new things. And I started my career, in fact, at Deloitte when it was called Deloitte Haskins & Sells. Yeah, so that's a while ago. Spent a number of years at GE Capital, spent a number of years at Stanford Research Institute in various finance and controller, took a couple of companies public, and then spent a number of years at Stanford Research Institute where I was in their consulting firm and ran it. Then I spent about 15 years at Hewlett-Packard, first as actually a business person. I was responsible for their sales and services for their services organization that was mostly focused on consulting and outsourcing. And then I shifted into HR, and that's a long story. But what I will tell you is the whole reason that I ended up going into HR is because at that time, HP was really looking for people to help drive the function that actually understood the business. They were going through major transformation as a business and major change as a business. And they really wanted the HR function to be one that was much more focused on business oriented types of challenges. And then I spent a number of years and did large roles at HP. I was head of sales learning and development for the entire sales organization. I was responsible for HR roles in their marketing organization. I was responsible for HR roles in their services and outsourcing, their global technology and operations. Having teams as large as 400 or 500 people, and I was also responsible for HR for all of Asia. I moved to Singapore for 3.5 years with my family, which was a great experience, by the way. Having my kids were like 4 and 6, so it was a great time for them to go. The biggest challenge was figuring out how to get our dog there, which is no easy task. But it was
imagine.
Yeah, but it was a wonderful experience. My kids still talk about it. But it was great for me because I also got a chance to really understand a lot of different cultures, had responsibility from India over to China, all the way down to the South Pacific. And then I spent a number of years doing some startup, a few startups and a couple of private equity companies. And then I landed here about a little over 5 years ago. And it's been a great experience at Northwestern. It's a fantastic company with unbelievable culture and values. And it's really the first company I've worked at where I felt like the noble purpose was real. You know, a lot of people, a lot of companies try to come up with a mission and a noble purpose, but when you have one where you're focused on really bringing to life the financial kind of, you know, end point that your clients are trying to get to, and you helping them achieve those things so they can live their lives, that's a pretty big deal. And it's a very mission-driven company, and it's been a great 5 years.
Very cool.
That's a heck of a journey and some very diverse experiences. You know, we talked a little bit in the pre-show about the size of the organization, that kind of stuff. But I think I'm struck, Don, because I didn't get a chance to do a lot of research on you before I jumped on the call. You worked at HP, which is a very well-known company, the garage startup, kind of the legendary thing, right? Just a bonus question or one that wasn't on our list.
It's okay.
Compaq was like, one of the big, I don't know if you were there when they acquired you.
I was.
You guys had EDS, which was a Ross Perot company, and you know, had its very own unique culture, and then was acquired, and then you had Compaq. So that was that HP and that conglomerate rolled up quite a big chunk of different corporate cultures and different histories, right? And we're going to talk about the culture and your approach to talent strategy at NML in a second, but can you just comment for a second on like what that dynamic was like to merge those cultures? Because that's such a hard thing, you know?
Well, it's one of the biggest, it's frankly one of, other than the business integration challenges that you have from a business standpoint, the cultural integration is probably the most impactful, and it's probably the least done well. And because most of the time, people really miss, they don't think about it to the extent, because usually mergers are driven by the business folks, and it's usually driven for business and product reasons. But it's, the work is still done by people. And one of the things that actually HP learned from that, because, you know, you've got Mercury, you've got Autonomy, you had a number, I mean, it was like 7, 8, 9 mergers. There's companies like Cisco that do it really well. And I think, and I wouldn't say that HP early on did it really well. And one of the things, Michael, we ultimately had to do was form what we call a mergers and acquisitions development organization. And after doing a couple of those, and they didn't go well, and HR played a very major role, and in fact was one of the major leaders of mergers and so forth, because of that reason of the cultural things that you talked about. And in fact, I played a very lead role in the EDS acquisition from an HR standpoint for that very reason. And really, what I would tell you fundamentally, it comes down to you need to have a strong culture to begin with, because if you don't, you're going to end up with an amalgamation that you don't want. And so what you have to ultimately really think about is, what are the core values of you as a company? There's things that you'll compromise on, you know, approaches, business processes, et cetera, but there's things you will not compromise on: the way you treat people, the way you think about your customers, the mission and values of what you do, how you compensate, how you reward, the integrity, those kind of things. And you better be really clear about what those things are. And so when you're bringing an acquisition in, you need to make sure that they're not, you know, that they understand, and it needs to be discussed in even at the very early stages of thinking about a merger. What you find is, if you don't talk about these things up front, because there's a lot of mergers that make sense on paper, but that doesn't mean they make sense from a mix of culture. And at the end of the day, when you don't do it well, you're not going to keep the key people that you need from either company, and that's ultimately what's going to bring the value of the merger and or the acquisition. And you know, and we learned that lesson at HP, frankly, the hard way. We did a couple of acquisitions where we lost a tremendous amount of the talent that we were hoping to bring over, because ultimately either they didn't like the way we did things, or we didn't want to do things the way they did them, et cetera. Right. And also just didn't engage them early enough. I mean, you know, it's funny how you'll be in the rooms, you'll be talking about a deal and you're forgetting about the fact that that deal doesn't really work if you don't keep key people. And I'm not just talking about the five or six that make all the money from it. I'm talking about, you know, down in the organization. Right. And how seldom that's even thought about in at those stages. And so, you know, the key is talent can't be thought of as a bolt on. It has to be threaded throughout the entire process. And and I'll talk about that. When I talk about D&I, when I talk about anything you want to try to do, you have to thread those principles within your entire talent process. They cannot be add-ons at stages. It has to just be built into the fabric of what you do.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Thanks. Let's get to the question I was supposed to ask you, which is let's look at the focus that you guys have at Northwestern Mutual Life, where you look to leverage a human plus data approach to level up your talent strategy. Mm-hmm. What's that look like in practice? Can you tell us what that looks like and what it is?
Well, one of the very early things that any CHRO worth their weight is going to do when they join a company is, first of all, understand what is the company trying to achieve from a business standpoint? What's the business strategy? What are you trying to accomplish from a business? And then therefore, what are the skills and capabilities you're going to need to be able to do that? Okay. And then what talent do you have and what capabilities and skills do they have? Where are your gaps and what are you going to do about it? And you use data. Because it's important that you understand what are the skills and capabilities you're going to need. What do you have? What are the gaps? And by the way, you apply the same thing when you look at, you know, early on, who's your top talent? Who are your critical people? Who do you need to keep? Who do you need? And I remember one of the very early meetings that I was in, and I was listening to this incredible discussion by our CEO when he was interviewing me about his talent and his vision for the business. And he got done and he did a great job explaining what he was trying to do from a business standpoint. And he looked at me and said, "What do you think?" I said, "I really only have one question." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "How do you know you have the talent to do that?" And, and he's looked at me like, "Huh, that's a really good question." And I remember I said, "The only way you're going to know that is you have to be really clear your vision and business strategy, your financial strategy and your talent strategy have to be in sync." Oftentimes businesses will have these really ambitious strategies that will require a level of talent that they don't even know whether they have or not. And of course, the answer can't be, let's just go hire people, because you may not be able to afford that. That may not be the timing you want. So we use data to really inform those kind of decisions by, you know, understanding the skills and capabilities of our people. You might have as part of your talent strategy that you want to increase your diversity. You want to increase your population of women. So you got to build that in. So one of the very first things I looked at from a data standpoint, hey, show me the top talent in the organization. Okay, great. And, you know, we use nine box. So like, who are the box ones, who are the box twos, fours kind of thing. All right, show me the women that are in those. Show me the people of color that are in those. And when you start seeing data will help you understand, you know, I when I first came here, I heard, wow, we were unbelievable D&I focus here. And I remember I said, well, show me the data. It's great that we get on stage and we talk about it. It's great that we talk about it in the press, but show me the data. What percentage of are the percentage of our people of color and women comparable to men? Are the number of top talent the same? What's the engagement scores? What does the survey data show? What is the, you know, how many promotions did we do last year? Is it proportional? You know, and you just use data as a powerful tool to really, in a way, it really sets the agenda for what you need to focus on, because people can say a lot of things anecdotally and a lot of things emotionally, but data doesn't lie. I mean, you know, you can say you have this big focus on D&I, but if your data shows that the results aren't there, then maybe you need to do something different. And so I use data. I combine data from the science side with the art side of what are you actually trying to do? And to me, what makes data so powerful is people can't really argue with it. They can argue with the way that you're going to tactically or strategically move forward, but they can't argue with the data.
Right. Right. You're starting with the starting point, really. Right.
It's a great baseline.
Yeah.
It's a great equalizer too, Robin, because I can tell you when you're trying to drive change and transformation, it's a very emotional thing, especially you take a company. Mm-hmm. This is a 160, you know, 5-year old company that's yeah. wildly successful, incredibly well intended, incredible values, mission driven, and everything else. And if you start out a conversation by telling them that they're doing something wrong, that is right. generally not going to go over well.
right.
But if you just show the data, well, hey, I understand that you know, here's what you really want. Well, here's what the data shows. Then people mm-hmm. they'll kind of like, yeah, that doesn't, you know, we've got mm-hmm. work to do. And so you don't, when you're trying to drive change, data can be a really powerful way to get people to actually at least be pointed in the right direction without having to get into an emotional discussion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, another area of work that has become very emotionally charged over the last several years and day to day, it seems, is remote work, and what that means, how it's changed, what companies yep. are doing to adjust or dial back or dial forward, whatever. You have taken a very planned approach to remote work, expanding your footprint as you've hired remote tech talent, as I know one example of that, but you've also focused on retaining that connectivity to mm-hmm. employees mm-hmm. As they're dispersed. So how do you promote that community building aspect of the culture, of the employee experience that you yep. have yep. built and nurtured?
Yeah, Robin, before I answer that, may I give just one more anecdote on the previous question?
Absolutely.
Yeah, one anecdote I wanted to add. When I came here, one of the things I consistently heard from people was how great the culture is. And we all know it was great. But when I got here, one of the things that I noticed when I did a bunch of roundtables and I did a bunch of, because the survey scores at that time were actually pretty low. And mm-hmm. and I remember hearing from leaders, you know, my people, everybody I talk to, they're feeling really great about things. And I said, mm-hmm. yeah, but you're only interacting with 30 or 40 people. So one of the things I started to do was talk to 2,000 or 3,000 people that nobody didn't come. It was a very relationship oriented company. And so yeah. I used data, because what I actually said was, well, hey, listen, you got a 45% engagement score over in these areas. So we're not doing something right there. By the way, I can report today that engagement across the entire company, across every, both yeah. genders, across every diversity, every geography is all north of 80%.
Awesome. That's
fantastic. And so you can't, you know, and remote employees included, which I'll talk about here in a second.
Yeah.
But that's an example of, you know, where somebody's like, people were really proud of the culture and there was a lot of really good things, but it was very easy to demonstrate it's not working for everybody. And so we have to use a more institutional approach, more sophisticated, a more modern approach to to make sure that everyone is getting those opportunities, not just the 50 to 100 people that we all know. And the key was expanding the population of people that had those opportunities by helping mm-hmm. them get exposure to the opportunities. And that's another way that data can be really powerful. But mm-hmm. but to your question about remote, I mean, listen, the biggest challenge that I think that most companies, we all know that the world is never going back to what it was pre-pandemic. I mean, we just experienced the largest simulation that you can work remotely and be effective that the world will ever go through. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the last pandemic wasn't during a time when you had computers and Zoom and everything else. So, you know, it was a different world, but we just experienced, you know, many of us, we used to do tests on, can we function if we have everybody remote in case we have a catastrophic event, we have to go remote for mm-hmm. a week. Well, mm-hmm. we just did that for years and it worked, you know, and we had productive, you know, our company had the greatest 2 years in its 166 year history during the mm-hmm. pandemic. So you can't say that you can't do it because we know that you can. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't things that suffered as a result of it. You know, we obviously know the challenges with mental illness and isolation and all these things. But what I consistently tell people, and when we think about it from a planning standpoint, is you have to stop thinking that proximity equals connectedness. We all know we have neighbors sometimes next door to us, so we may talk, you know, once a year, and you have family members that live out across the country that you're going to see a lot more often because you intentionally make an effort. So to me, connectedness is what makes connectedness, not proximity. And so even if you're in the same office and you never actually meet at the water cooler and talk to each other, you know, so you could be in the same office, but if you're spending all your time on Zoom meetings and everything else, what's the
right.
point? Where's the advantage of that? So what we've done much more intentionally is really reinforce and really re-engage with our people leaders to recognize that you have to intentionally make much more of an effort to connect with your people, whether they're in person or whether they're remote. And if they're remote, you have to even make much more of an effort. So even if we've got somebody remote, for example, that doesn't come into the office, that lives in another state, because we have about 2,000 employees, about 25% of our employee base is remote, not near a location. So you have a significant, and a lot of them are technology folks. What that did was allow us to recruit and be able to really grow our talent base for skills that we absolutely had to have and couldn't find in Milwaukee and New York. But at the same time, we recognized that we needed to connect those people. So we had to rethink the way we did onboarding. We had to rethink the way we connected with them. We had to be much more intentional about regular one-on-ones and like sessions like this, for example, Robin. I do 5 to 10 of these kind of sessions a week with 20 to 30 employees at a time. So I'm talking to 200 to 300 employees a month, just doing these kind of, hey, how's it going? What can we do? What's working? What's not? And if you get all your people leaders doing that, you get all, and in fact, we do a program called Project Uplift for our Black and African-American, Hispanic and populations. And we're doing it now for other populations as well, where every member of the senior leadership team meets with members of those communities. And we just use this much more intentional, planned, organized kind of informal discussion. So it's not, we don't orchestrate it to where, hey, these are the 6 questions and we're going to, it's unscripted. It's just people talking to people. And the beauty of it is at first it was a little awkward for people, but now everybody knows when they get on a call with me, they can ask me anything. They can tell me anything. They can talk about what's working, what's not. So it's just a very powerful way to connect with people. And then the momentum of that just kind of takes care of itself. Before you know it, all of a sudden people are asking for those kind of things and they're reaching out to it. Managers are using it as a tool. And I wouldn't say we're perfect at it, but I would tell you, if you can make remote employees feel the same as if they're in person, if you make the right level of effort. That doesn't mean we never want them to come in, because there's nothing more impressive than walking through our building and realizing what you're part of and excited. Yeah. It still gives me goosebumps. I remember the first time I walked through it, but it doesn't have to be every week. It doesn't have to be every month. It's all about connecting. You have to connect. Mm-hmm. We are human beings. We want to connect with each other. And that's the real key.
Mm-hmm. Hey Don, I threw in an extra question there. I said at the beginning, and now it's of course selfishly teetered us towards the end of messing up some time. So I'm going to change up a little bit the question.
I can go longer if you need to, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I mean, it's all good, but I know we try to stick kind of 30 minutes, but if we roll over, that's good. We won't cut you off, but kind of maybe roll DEI into this question. But in your role as CHRO, you've talked about it a little bit already, but you play a critical role driving strategy and change. Mm-hmm. How do you characterize your approach and mindset? And maybe you can frame that up around your DEI initiatives and some of the other things you've mentioned.
How do I frame my mindset in terms of the role I play in
How do you characterize your approach and mindset in driving change?
Oh, well, I mean, my approach is one of really painting a vision of what we're trying to get to. I think the most powerful thing you can do is align on outcomes. I tend to avoid getting into discussions about the how until I really focus on what's the what, right? Mm-hmm. Because I often find that people are much more aligned on what you want, in terms of what you want. Like, for example, DEI was a great example here. The company here, they really wanted to have a much more diverse environment. And they wanted to, I'll give you 2 examples. And they wanted to have a more performance driven environment. And I remember when I got here, I met with my CEO and a few other folks, and they said, we want a performance driven culture. We want more DEI. And I remember I said to them, that's interesting. And they said, well, why is that? I said, because there's nothing tactically that I can see that you're doing that's going to make that happen. And, you don't fire people, you reward people you pay more in an egalitarian way. You don't hold managers accountable if they don't hit those D&I targets, you don't measure it, and I just went through the list of, it doesn't mean that they didn't value it, but it's like, I first tried to align on what are you actually, and then I said, so tell me what it is you actually want, what does success actually look like? You know, do you, are you trying to get a population that's 30%, you know, we went from, by the way, 9% people of color to 30% people of color in my time. Wow. And, you know, we've gone from almost 50% of our employees or actually 50% of our employees are women. Almost 50% of our leadership, our people leaders are now women. But the only way we could get to that was we had to have an alignment. Is that what you're trying to get to? Because then you can say, well, if that's what you want to get to, these are the types of things you need to think about. You know, and you know, you align on the outcome, and then it's much easier to have the discussion about, well, how are you going to get there? And then what is it going to look like? And, you know, because it, a lot of times people get hung up on debating the tactics without really understanding, you know, most of the times they're in agreement on where they're trying to get to. Cause I'll have discussions with people where I'm like, okay, well, this is what we want to get to. There's several different ways we can get there. Rather than having debates about tactics. A lot of times one way isn't the only way, you know, to get to the same outcome. And so, in fact, I'll get in disagreements with some of my colleagues that have been here a long time. And by the way, they're fabulous colleagues. All of them, I love them. But I'll be like, they'll talk about this way that's, you know, that they think. And I'll be like, hey, that's fine. And I know that's worked for you for a business process, but there's 9 other things you could do too. And that may be the best. But how about if we take a white sheet approach where we just take that, set it aside for a second, and just take an undefined approach and look, and maybe we might come up with a different answer that might be better. Maybe it'll be your answer. But, you know, I try to avoid debates on tactics and try to spend more time on aligning on the outcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we've done with, you know, we're now much more performance-driven culture. We've implemented performance management to a much, much more aggressive degree. We still, hey, listen, we're not Wall Street. We're still a nice company. We still want to treat people well and everything else, but we want to hold people more accountable if they're not doing the things we need them to do. And DEI is a great example that we all aligned in what we were trying to do, because trust me, you can't get those kind of results if you're not getting the whole company behind you. But, you know, we had to do things like, once we aligned on that, then we changed, we required slating, we required, you know, metrics, we built it into our performance process. We actually built it into our bonus program. So then you do a lot of things tactically to make that happen, and you get a lot more support for change to the things you need to do tactically if you're aligned on the outcome.
That's great. What have you put your prognosticator hat on here for a moment? Sure. And tell us what you believe are some of the trends and the themes in HR, in the world of work, that you anticipate will kind of dominate the landscape, the HR landscape here through the rest of the year into next year.
Well, I think there's 2 or 3 themes. We can dive into a few of them. Return to campus is still a big debate. You know, there are still absolutely leaders out there that believe we can go back to the way it was, bring people back in, you know, that people need to be in the office 3, 4, 5 days a week or they're not productive. And I think that's still a pretty significant debate. And you know, and that's a trend that I think will continue for the next year or two. I worry about if you get too heavy handed with that, what does that do for women? What does that do for people of color? Mm-hmm. What does that do, you know, and making you attractive? You know, and I really do believe that that's a big question. I think another one that to me, Robin, the thing I'm most passionate about is, and I'm spending most of my energy on over the next year or two, is starting to figure out a way to really put our money where our mouth is in the HR function. We've talked for years about the employee and the shareholder or the customer on the same plane, but we've rarely done anything from a culture and an institutional standpoint to make that actually happen. What I mean by that is if you really want to put an employee on the same level with a customer or shareholder, then you need to make sure while they're delivering for the customer, they're also delivering for themselves, which means the way you do talent management, the way you do career development, the way you do career growth has got to be much more intentional towards helping make sure they're achieving their career plans while they're doing the work. So you have to be much more clear about what their career plans are. You have to have managers that are more career guides, not just getting the work done. And you have to institutionalize that whole process, which is not easy. And that's a big one. And then I think another one is AI. I really think about, you know, what is AI, what is the capabilities in that area going to do to roles that are administrative or data oriented, you know, anything that's going to be, you know, able to be computerized. And so you know, as I start thinking about roles in the next 2 to 3 years, you know, efficiency and how things are done, that's going to, I think that's going to have a material impact to a lot of the, you know, we have a lot of call center roles. We have a lot of, you know, data transcribe kind of roles. We have, what is it going to do to those kind of things? And I get nervous when I hear people prognosticating what's, you know, that, you know, three hundreds of millions of jobs are going to be eliminated and all these kind of things when we don't even know exactly how we're going to secure an environment to, you know, I mean, I do think that's going to have a massive impact, but I think there's many intricate details that have still got to be worked out. Mm-hmm. And then Robin, I'd say the last one, I think in their function, HR people have to realize that you have to be able to speak the language of the business. I think a trend that's going to get even more so over the next, you know, number of years is if you want to be a successful senior HR person, you have to be able to communicate with business people the way they see the world. Budgets are getting tighter. You know, we've seen it with layoffs and everything else. Challenges are getting to be bigger and more complex. And if you're going to be the senior HR folks and really driving the talent strategies, you have to have a seat at the table that, you know, if you're sitting around our SL senior leadership team, you're not going to know who's the HR person from who's the product person, from who's the client experience. You need to be able to actually represent all elements of the business, and because otherwise, how do you design the talent strategies? How do you design the cultural strategies? And so I think the more that HR folks can realize that just having domain expertise is not enough, and then they need to really understand how the business works.
I kind of a piece of that, because again, knowing your background and the accounting and marketing and the business background, you know, coming and then layering on HR on top of that, have you ever had, and maybe you do at NML, but or have you ever built sort of rotational programs for HR folks on your team so that they do go out and they spend time in a marketing role or whatever?
We've done that. We did that at Hewlett Packard quite a bit. It was much more institutionalized. We actually created a program called the Managing MAP program, which was all about rotations. It wasn't necessarily outside the function, but it was all elements of the function, which had business elements in it. And I've seen those kind of programs. GE obviously did that in my GE days. It's one of the things that I actually really highly recommend that companies can do. It's harder to do when you have smaller organizations, obviously.
Yeah.
And companies they always do a great job of the send out. It's the send back part that's always the challenge, right? Because the timing doesn't always seem to work. Somebody's got to have a role, you know, and so forth. But I strongly believe in those kind of things. And my advice would be do them in small doses first. You know, 4, 5, 6, get some success points. We've done it here with, you know, small numbers, sent people out to the business. We do that a lot actually with our home office employees, sending them out to the field, the sales organization in the field, and then bringing them back.
Yeah.
Cause it's all about perspective, Robin. It's the more perspective you can bring to the table when you're as an executive, the more that you're going to be effective. And so whether it's a business perspective, a field perspective, a geographical perspective, a functional perspective, those are very powerful things. And unfortunately, you can't train your way to that. You have to experience it. Honestly believe that the currency of the future when it comes to HR is your experience, your perspective, your skills. It's not your title, not your role. It's really the currency is going to be what you can do and what you can bring. And the faster that we move as companies to value in that versus titles and roles, and I think this next generation is all over this. The faster I think we'll be in a position where it's about truly the talent, you know, not about hierarchy and titles and roles.
So we're going to wrap up in a second, Don. I'm going to ask another bonus question though, just sure. to kind of, so, you know, what you just said, very true. I agree with everything you just said related to the senior leadership and, you know, but the challenge, and Robin alluded to one way, which is kind of a formal program of rotational program. But let's just say you're at mid-level HR business partner, you know, and they hear what you say, right? Mm-hmm. How do they go do that with all the complex things that HR business partners, because we're still in many ways a business department of many hats, right? We switch out from labor relations to, you know, it's comp, blah, blah, blah. So how does it, beyond just, you know, living life and at 100 miles an hour, how does an HR business partner get to where you are now? How do they do that intentionally? Can you give us some advice for those folks that will be listening in?
Well, and it's the same thing that I talked about at the beginning. You have to understand that, first of all, the career goals, HR is not immune from that. We should have the same kind of career planning that we offer the company. So I can tell you what I'm doing. I've got people on my team. I'm going to be retiring in a few years. And I've got people on my team that want my role. And so the first thing you have to sit down and do, whether it's my role, whether it's the level below me or a couple levels down, understand, what does it take to be successful in those roles? What are the experiences? What are the skills? What are the capabilities? And really be intentional. So what an HR business partner should do in the mid-level is they should really be sitting down with their leader and their that they report to, and really understanding what it is they want to accomplish in their career. Do they want to be the CHRO? Do they want to be the head of comp? Do they? Because you shouldn't make an assumption of what somebody wants to do. You should really understand what is it you're aspiring to. And then you should really sit down, and this is where the science piece comes in. Well, what are the types of skills and capabilities you're going to need to have? What are the types of experiences? What are the type of perspectives? And then be very intentional to try to help them get those things, whether it's part-time assignments. Like, for example, you know, I sit down with people on my team and one level below. I know so-and-so wants this job. So, hey, that's an assignment that's a two-month project. That would really be good for them because they need to build some finance skills. And I'm going to go have them go work with the finance team on this plan that we're going to be doing to change the budget, you know, or because there's a number of things that you need to be really good at to be sitting in my chair, whether it's finance, whether it's how to make executive presentations to boards and SLTs, how to make persuasive arguments. You know, all these kinds of things, which you're not going to necessarily get just from being a business partner. And so you have to be really understand what those pieces and parts are to be a successful CHRO or whatever level you're trying to get to, and be very intentional about getting the person those skills. Document it, track it. You know, I mean, I had like a person on my team that is really, really good. It's really smart and wants to be a CHRO. And when I got here, you know, a handful of years ago, I said to them, I will help you learn the things you need to learn so you'll be a great one. And we've been very intentional about that. So the experiences that I've been trying to get for him are all designed to get him ready for that. And it's also going to be as simple as just exposing him to things. But it all starts with being very intentional and very thoughtful about what it is you're trying to get to. And what I would say if you're an HR business partner is don't get so caught up in the work that you forget about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And having your hierarchy, your manager, your mentors support you as well.
Don't have it be episodic. Don't have it be episodic. It's got to be intentional.
Great advice.
Don't let it happen to you. Correct. Too often we let it happen to us.
Robin, sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say one of the key things that we did for our employee value proposition was our theme was choose your path. We don't care what you choose, but you have to choose because if you don't, then we can't build a plan for you.
Mm-hmm. But that is awesome advice. I appreciate you answering the question so well. Hopefully that will, you know, prompt a couple people to maybe think about how they're approaching their careers. I want to thank you for being on Drive Through HR today, Don. I really enjoyed the conversation. I know Robin was really looking forward to it as well. Before we wrap up, can you share whatever info that you might be willing to part with about how people might reach out to you if they wanted to get in touch?
Sure. I have my LinkedIn page, Don Robertson, is probably the best way. So you can go, you know, there's a lot of good information of previous articles and things that we published there. They can also go to the website, Northwestern Mutual, and reach me that way. But if somebody reaches out to me via the LinkedIn, I'm usually pretty good about responding pretty quickly. So, and my team does a great job. So happy to help. I mean, at this stage of my career, happy to help in any way I can.
Awesome. Robin, you want to take us out?
I am ready to take us out. Don, thank you so much. And I told Don this in our pre-show, but I will just let everybody else know. He, once upon a time, NML's HR department was my dream job when I lived in Milwaukee. So if he's got an opening when you go to connect with him, I think you'll all want to explore working on his team now. So thanks again, Don. Thank you, Michael. And we are out of here.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. That was... That was a lot of fun. I hope that was good for you guys.